coming. I hope you don't mind if I sit down so I've got access to my notes and slides. Yeah, as Mariam says, well, this talk I'm doing is basically a preamble for the... it was just really to set some context for the screening we're doing in a couple of weeks' time in the Regent Street Cinema, which I don't know if you've been there or not, but I mean, you probably would have walked past it if you come past from Oxford Circus Tube. Amazing venue. It's like, was the birthplace of cinema in the UK. It's when the, I can't remember, was it the Lumiere brothers first did their first projections, 1896, and it was functioning as a cinema up until the 80s, then closed, and now it's been refurbished in this beautiful Art Deco, Edwardian style, and state-of-the-art projection. And we're lucky, this particular film, Song, was part of, well, three silent films, and there was a couple of other talkies that Anna May Wong made in Europe. She came to Europe in 1928, and I'll talk a bit about that. But best known of these films is Piccadilly, which is out on DVD, and there's two others, Song and Pavement Butterfly, which are both in the British Film Institute's archive. So we've got a 35mm print, which hardly ever gets screened, and it's never been on DVD or television or whatever, so it's really your only chance to see the film. It's not been pirated and stuck on YouTube or anything, so this is really the only chance. So I hope you'll be able to come and see the magic of Anna May Wong in this film, and please spread the word. Yeah, the other reason we chose this film basically to announce... you know, our new venue we're using for the Asia House Film Festival, which, as Marin says, is in February, the end of February 2016, is going to be largely at the Regent Street Cinema. And this particular film was also there to introduce the theme of the festival for next year, which is going with the sort of globalisation, transnationalism. We're calling it Erasing Boundaries or something of that ilk, but basically looking at a broader definition of Asia rather than this, when people say Asia, everyone tends to think of the usual suspects, China and Japan and Korea and India, but we're spreading our nets wider to look at other filmmaking cultures as well as these, so Kazakhstani cinema, anyone? So, right, well, let me begin with the story of Anna May Wong. So, I'd say my first introduction to Anna May Wong was in the film Piccadilly, which was the third silent film she made in the UK. And I've said this idea of transnationalism is particularly pertinent with Anna May Wong because she was Chinese-American making films in London with German directors, with a French name in this case, E.A. Dupont, who, probably this is one of his best-known films, E.A. Dupont's Piccadilly. Another film he made, Variété, was just recently digitalised, restored and screened at London Film Festival this year, a 1925 film set in a circus, trapeze artist. So he was obviously into this sort of gaudy, lavish sort of showbiz milieu. Anna May Wong, in this film, she plays a scullery maid who works in the basement of a high-class nightclub in Piccadilly, and the owner of the nightclub finds her, sees her dancing on the table, and takes a shine to her, and puts her on stage, and she becomes the talk of the town, and he eventually falls for her, and gets shot for his troubles, and... it ends with Anna May Wong dead. So this was a recurring theme in a lot of her films, actually. She tended to, as she was always complaining about, she'd like to be in a film where she didn't die at the end. And also, a lot of the films, certainly all of the British ones, she plays a nightclub dancer or some variation of that. So she's a knife thrower's assistant in Song. Unfortunately, the knife thrower goes blind halfway through the film, so it's obviously not a... safe profession for her. But Piccadilly was one of those films. It got reissued by the BFI on DVD in 2004, and I think that really kick-started this sort of resurgence of interest in Anna May Wong, because she wasn't that well-known. I mean, she was famous back in the day, in the 20s and 30s, but probably in the last 50 years after that, no one was talking about her. And if you look at old books on silent cinema or classical Hollywood, Her name, she gets a cursory mention, you might see the odd still, but no one really talks about her life. So one of the things when I saw this film, I was just scratching my head going, who is she and why is, was she Chinese, was she American, was she British, why is she appearing in a British film? And that really intrigued me to find out more about her. And luckily there's quite a big selection of literature on her, which actually coincidentally all turned up roughly about the same time as Piccadilly came out. So the first book actually was 2003, Anna May Wong, A Complete Guide to Her Films, Stage, Radio and Television Work, which is a very exhaustive reference book which gives details of all her films, where the prints are, brief synopses, running time and stuff like that, but it doesn't really tell you much about her. But the best one, I believe, is Anna May Wong, From Laundryman's Daughter to Hollywood Legend, which is really a complete account of her life, probably the most... it's the one which I think all the other sources borrow from. So that's really the narrative established by the author, Graham Hodges. And then after that came Perpetually Cool, The Many Lives of Anna May Wong by Anthony B. Chan, an America, Chinese-American, which more looks at her place in the sort of... cultural, racial context of America. I think he's a bit too forceful, some of his arguments, actually. It makes you feel guilty for being white and watching films with her in it. So, and more theory and opinion than fact. And then came the documentary in 2008, Frosted Yellow Willows, which is her name, the Chinese characters to spell her name. Which I don't know if I've got, I can't remember what her Chinese... That's it. I won't try repeating that. and she had, around about this time, she had quite a few retrospectives of her work across North America, and I was involved in, there was a couple of screenings at the BFI in 2009 at Piccadilly, and Pavement Butterfly, which was the other British silent film she made, and that was, took place in to commemorate Chinese New Year in 2009, the British Film Institute, and they also showed Frosted Yellow Willows. And then there's Shining Star, the Anna May Wong story by Paula Yu and illustrated by Lin Wang, which is really nice, actually, a children's book, but aimed probably for young, I mean, like young adults, 11, 12-year-olds. So really, again, going through the story of her life as recounted by Graham Hodges, but with really nice pictures. So, and then recently... and I mentioned there was also a Radio 4 documentary of Celestial Star in Piccadilly, which was done by Anna Chen, and it was talking specifically about her stay in the UK, in London. And this documentary came out this year, To Climb a Gold Mountain, A Portrait of Struggle and Triumph, which looks at the lives of Chinese-American, some crucial Chinese-American women, and giving the backdrop of the story of the Chinese in America. And that came out this year. Anna May Wong gets quite a large section in that. And I'm going to really go through some of the details from this film to set the backdrop of the sort of world that Anna May Wong was born into. So imagine you've got Los Angeles, the 1850s, was the, you know, this was the real Wild West at the time, of the just the beginning of the Gold Rush. And the first Chinese settlers moved to America in 1849. Apparently the first woman arrived in 1852 and committed suicide like about a month later. Because I guess at this point, as I say, it was a rowdy Wild West town, and a lot of the women brought over were prostitutes, sex slaves, and lived in pretty awful conditions. And men outnumbered women 20 to 1, lots of human trafficking going on, and there were lots of Chinese gangs, the Tongs there, were sort of... that's ruled the Chinatown area there. So I think this was probably, in the American imagination, was how they viewed Chinatown, you know, as sort of lawless sort of place, which was beyond their understanding. And so I think that coloured a lot of the narratives we see in the early films. Yeah, and of course, America is a whole population of immigrants, but that sign, well, still to this day, it's white are considered the top of the pile, so the Chinese were looked down. There was especially a lot of prejudice against the Chinese. There was the so-called Night of Horrors in 1871, where those gangs descended on Chinatown and killed about 18 people, and Chinese people, and that was tied down to those usual fears about immigration, about Chinese labourers undercutting wages and just basic racial prejudice. And after that, there was a case, lots of Chinese were put on boats and set out to sea and said, go home. And it led to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which stopped Chinese immigrants from naturalising as American settlers and owning land, setting up businesses. And I think it's the only law in American history which has specifically been targeted at a particular ethnic group. And it was only repealed in 1943. So this was like 60 years. Basically, if you look at that stretched the whole of Anna May Wong's career. Going specifically to Anna May Wong, is a portrait of Anna May Wong. She was third generation Chinese. Her grandfather had come across, and she was born in Flower Street in Los Angeles' Chinatown on 3rd of January 1905, above her father's laundry. Her father owned a laundry. And she actually, even while she was, quite far into her acting career, she was still working at the laundry part-time. but she was the second daughter of seven children, and she was unusually tall for the time. She was 5'7", and she was very curious. At that time, it's interesting, because the American film industry was born on the East Coast in New York with the Edison Company, and Hollywood only really began around 1905, the time she was born. So Hollywood started off with companies beginning production in California because the light was better quality, and so you had all these small outfits beginning film production that eventually morphed into all these companies like Universal and 20th Century Fox that we know today. And a lot of the... they would be shooting on the streets. They'd be filming productions. And Anna May Wong, when she was running errands or going to school, she would often see these films and as a bystander, would go there and be in awe of this whole magical apparatus called cinema. And eventually, this ended up with her, asking for work as an extra. And she had her first screen role in a film called The Red Lantern by Albert Capellani, 1920, which was a massive star vehicle for Anna Nazimova, who was a famous Russian actress who was big in America at the time. I thought this film was lost, certainly in the time when Graham Hodges was writing his book. He was saying this film was lost. And then I read somewhere that there was a copy in Brussels in the film museum there, but it was so bad quality that it was going to cost thousands of, about $40,000 or something to restore it. And that's the sad tragedy of a lot of silent films, that the prints get so degraded that even if a film exists still, it's financially not viable to restore it. But I just found out when Googling around trying to find an image for it that it has recently been restored by and is available in DVD in Brussels, so I need to track down a copy. It was filmed in the streets of Chinatown in Los Angeles, and she was cast as an actor, and it tells the story of a Eurasian Joan of Arc-like heroine set against the background of China's 1900 Boxer Rebellion. And all shot in California. Another typical role she was in, another uncredited role, was Dinty, I think is lost, 1920 silent drama written by Marshall Neelan, the director of this film, who specifically for Wesley Barry, this young actor here, who was known for his freckled complexion and played cute kid roles, and He's a newsboy in this film whose fight to care for his ailing mother leads him into conflicts with the other boys on the street and then with drug smugglers in Chinatown. So again, we're getting this idea of like, Chinatown being this sort of evil den of vice. And Anna May Wong was, again, largely uncredited roles this time. And her first credited role was in this film, Bits of Life. Again, Marshall Needham's director. And this is sort of, it's a shame this one's lost, actually. We've got the stills. But it was the first ever omnibus film. It's made up of four short stories. So the first episode was entitled The Bad Samaritan, the second was The Man Who Heard Everything, the third episode was Hop, and the fourth episode was The Intrigue. So first anthology film ever, first credited role for Anna May Wong, and the first role for a guy called Lon Chaney. I don't know if you know the name. Here he is here. He was the so-called Man of a Thousand Faces, who appeared in things like Phantom of the Opera, but basically played quite a lot of Chinese roles in what they call yellow face, you know, because at the time the laws were that racial miscegenation laws, you couldn't have, they never cast Asian actors for the lead roles, and you couldn't have sort of on-screen romances between people of different races. And Lon Chaney basically, he was played a lot of these roles, Fu Manchu and a lot of films we're going to go on later. And that was his first major role in Bits of Life. So her first leading role was in Toll of the Sea, and this is an interesting film because it was also the first film ever shot in the two-strip subtractive Technicolor number 2 process. So one of actually the first colour feature films, immersely about 55 minutes long. Feels a lot longer than I have to say. But you can see it on YouTube. It got restored, I think, in the 80s and put out on video. She was, only 16 when this was filmed, and it's basically the narrative, it's a version of Madame Butterfly. It's an American sailor gets washed up on the shores of China, and she rescues him, falls in love with her, he impregnates her, and then sails off back to America after marrying her and saying, you know, you can come to America back with me, I'll just go back and set up home first, and of course he goes back and shacks up with an American woman, and then goes back and sees a mixed race child, and then Anna May Wong is abandoned in China and ends up killing herself, dying at the end. So it's lots of shots of her crying and generally looking miserable. So I have a little clip actually of it here. I can find the right place. There we saw it. Thank you. So, I mean, obviously, that wasn't filmed in China. And I guess one thing that's very important to remember is that after the war, there wasn't really overseas location shooting. Everything was, you know, you had a film that was nominally set in Japan, and it would be a reconstructed version of Japan, or these sort of very much these sort of fantasy, imaginary sort of ideas of what the East or other countries were like. And you can even see it in, I know I watched recently an Anna May Wong film, Study in Scarlet, with the Sherlock Holmes story, and it was all shot in California, and this idea of like trying to recreate London, the idea of recreating this was a fake version of London in California. You see similar sort of aspects of stereotyping and construction. The other interesting thing is that I've noticed that any new cinema technology that comes along, be it colour, widescreen or whatever, they always invoke these sort of very foreign settings, especially exotic Eastern settings. So like I think of the Paul and Pressburger version of the Arabian Nights. I've got the Thief of Baghdad was an early Technicolor film, and then you had first widescreen colour film, one of the very first CinemaScope colour films, House of Bamboo, set in Tokyo, actually shot in Tokyo in this case, and even stuff like Avatar. I mean, it's sort of exotic fantasy land, isn't it, really? So you can see it sort of continuum. Yeah, and of course, I think cinema was key to America's cultural ascendancy in the 20th century. I mean, cinema is the way. And I'm sort of curious as to what extent that was a conscious effort of, like, American studios setting out to colonise the world with their own image and to sort of enforce a view of how the world should be through cinema, even as early as this time, in the 1920s, a lot of Hollywood films were shown in China, especially in the 30s, and in Japan. There was a lot of imports. And that's the thing that's always interested me, is that before the Second World War, just how porous national boundaries were in terms of cinema, even though it's difficult for people to travel, for average people, but there was a big flow of cinema techs and also labour, as you see in the London films, the German money, German directors, Chinese-American stars. So, again, it ties in this idea of transnationalism. It's surprising when you look in the 20s and 30s how prominent it was. And in this film, Toll of the Sea, we saw the example how race was inscribed even in the level of the subtitling, which I think is very interesting. So, yes, we can quote Edward Said, always bring out in these moments his quote on Orientalism. He says, "The Orient is less a place than a topos, a set of references, of congeries of characteristics that seems to have its origin in a quotation or a fragment of text or a citation from someone else's work on the Orient or some previous bit of imagining or an amalgam of all these. So this idea, you know, the East. In Piccadilly, for example, the nightclub dancer, I mean, when she's there, her name is Shosho, sounds more Japanese than Chinese. She's dressed up in a strange Thai costume, playing an instrument that looks like a shamisen. It's just this mixture of like various Asian cultures. There's nothing authentic about it at all. And we can see this. After this, she became, you know, this was her first starring role, and she started getting parts in big Hollywood productions. Peter Pan and The Thief of Baghdad were her two biggest roles. In fact, she plays the Mongol slave in this, the Douglas Fairbanks version of The Thief of Baghdad, and all the critics were like, you know, she pretty much stole the show. I mean, she was like a massive screen presence. I really like the 1924 version of Peter Pan. You remember, this is like actually before the Disney version made us think what Peter Pan was. You know, actually, it's really dark. It's like it's a very interesting adaptation of the original novel. And she plays Tiger Lily, the Native American Indian, in the film. And yeah, this was typical of the type of casting she had, where she was basically playing anyone that wasn't white. You know, she was playing like Mongol slave girl, the Inuit and the Alaskan. A lot like, I mean, I always think of like one of her frequent co-stars in these films was the Japanese actor Sesue Hayakawa, who was in the incredibly racist Cecil B. DeMille silent film, The Cheat. But it's probably better known, everyone will remember him in Bridge of the River Kwai as the Japanese general, isn't it? But what's interesting with the Alaskan, you know, she was born in California. She'd never been to China at this point. In fact, she'd never been outside of America. And the first time she went outside of America was she had to go up to Canada to film the Alaskan. And the Chinese Exclusion Act meant that all Chinese in America had to have apply for permission to leave and to come back in and carry a registration card. And this is her card that she had at this time. You see, age 30. Actually, this was probably from a later date, not from the Alaskan, but identifying feature, mole on the back of her neck, pit mark on forehead, small scar inside her left thumb. The sort of mugshot she has here. 5'6¼". So anyway, the first time she left North America was in 1928. She was 23 at the time when she went with her sister Lulu and set sail across the Atlantic for Europe. But why did she leave for Europe? Well, it is a good idea. Here we have the sort of films she was appearing in at the time. Mr. Wu. Again, we have Lon Chaney in Yellow Face and a French actress, Renée Adderay, because she's a love interest, so you can't have the law, you can't have love interest between a white actor and a Chinese actress at the time. Other roles she had, she usually played prostitutes, villainesses, femme fatales, films like, we have 1926, A Trip to Chinatown, Fifth Avenue, The Chinese Parrot, The Streets of Shanghai. So all these sort of, they all seem to come in the late 20s, actually. There seems to be a glut of these sort of evil Chinatown narratives. And she never had leading roles in these films. She would just be...
I'm sorry, I have a question. Or is it open to questions? Yeah.
I
was wondering, was she able to financially sustain herself well enough?
I guess she was making a living as an actress. I mean, but pay actually something you'll come on to a bit later. She wasn't like at this stage. She was just appearing in supporting roles. I wouldn't say she was really a big star, but she was a bit player. People knew who she was. You know, the name attached to her. One of the interesting films, actually, she was in a film called The Silk Bouquet in 1926, which is lost, but it was a Chinese-American film made for Chinese-American audiences, starring Chinese-Americans. So there was this whole sub-industry, and you have it the same with African-Americans as well. There's a large amount of films made in the 1920s, so it makes you realise how segregated even audiences were at that point. So, you know, as we were saying, because of these laws about anti-miscegenation, you couldn't have a screen kiss. That basically meant she couldn't appear in romantic leads. So she was never going to be like a major actress in Hollywood. Yes, well, we have Mr. Wu. So this is silent movie star Lon Chaney, Man of a Thousand Faces, as the Chinese patriarch who tries to exact revenge on the Englishman who seduced his daughter. The supporting cast includes Anna May Wong. So anyway, she came to Europe and signed up a 5-picture deal with Richard Eichberg, who directed her in Song. And then this is the second film, Großstadt Schmetterling, Pavement Butterfly, also known as City Butterfly. So these three silent, she signed 5-picture deal, but the first three of these were silent films. This is what my interest in Anna May Wong is not looking at her from the perspective of an American or a Chinese American, but from a British viewpoint of British cinema. What did she mean to British? And she came over and it was like, wow, an American star wants to appear in our films. And she was like hailed as this, you know, this amazing thing. And what was interesting was the other films you see that she was obviously slot in just because the face fits. You know, we need a Chinese prostitute and we'll get Anna May Wong. Whereas these films are very much constructed around her. So films like, well, Piccadilly Song, Pavement Butterfly were made with Anna May Wong already decided. We know she's going to be the star, so let's build a film around her. Yeah, I've got some contemporary reviews from the three films that appeared in Variety at the time. So this interests the American perspective, because Americans, I always think, in the 20s, you look at Variety and they always sneer at European films, even German stuff. All the German stuff we consider classics now. I remember seeing reviews, like, oh, it's got that horrible, murky cinematography that the Germans seem to love. And it's like almost like they're intolerant of other national cinemas, even in these days when cinema was this international language. So Song, they say, Richard Eichberg's first film for British International Pictures, surefire for Germany, and from the trade show reports would seem to be set for England. And they describe her as the little Malaysian girl. Anna May Wong is, that's what she plays in the, not what they were referring to her, the actress, but the role she plays. They say Anna May Wong is charming, but Heinrich George as the painter has a coarse brutality which no American audience would ever stomach in a would-be sympathetic role. Eichberg's directing is better than usual. Kind of. Pavement Butterfly, she plays a little sideshow dancer. No, it was described as little. She plays a little sideshow dancer who flees the attractions of a brutal clown. She takes refuge with a young painter who makes money selling portraits of her. The clown finds her again, steals her money from her, which she has gotten for the painter. The review also goes on to state that the main part could have been played by a girl of any race. So, well, so what? I mean, that's why aren't there girls of other races in more films in this time, I think we could ask. And then there's Piccadilly. Now, the other thing is, Piccadilly wasn't just, Anna May Wong wasn't the only Hollywood star in there. There was the blonde actress, Gilda Gray, whose name we don't remember today so much. But they say a good picture in the silent days could have made the deluxe first runs over here with its Gilda Gray name. The owner of the class joint digs up a, using a derogatory racial slur here, dancer from the scullery. So it's an amazing sort of language that you could get away with in the Variety of trade show paper at the time. From the moment Miss Wong dances in the kitchen's rear, she steals Piccadilly from Miss Gray. And he describes its badly muddled finale. But the big thing that counted against it at the time was it was silent. This was 1929, and it was the end of the silent era. And Alfred Hitchcock's Blackmail had been just released in America like a month before Piccadilly. And so when it actually circulated in America, it had a synced soundtrack attached to the film. And it mentions 3% dialogue. And if you look at the BFI disc of it, there's an introduction bit where two of the characters are talking, two of the male characters are talking, going, you know, this is what happened, this is how I ended up destitute. And that's the only bit of dialogue in the whole film. I mean, it is a silent film, but at this time, silent was on the way out. So again, I mentioned my interest from a European perspective, and this is the photo that always really intrigues me. I don't know if anyone knows who these three... Well, we know Anne Mae Wong in the centre. On the left, we have Marlene Dietrich, who this was taken at the Berlin Press Ball in January 1929, and these, I think, like three amazing women who are at the sort of, say, peak of their career, or their career looked like it was going to be at the peak, and within 10 years, they were all pretty much over. Anne Mae Wong, I think, at this point, was probably had the most established track record, but Marlene Dietrich had a stage career throughout the 20s and then hit her stride. She was getting big screen roles by this time, but she really hit her stride with a breakthrough with Joseph von Sternberg's The Blue Angel, playing sexy cabaret singer Lola Lola, and that was her first international hit. And that led to her following von Sternberg over to Hollywood, where she was contracted to Paramount, who Anne Mae Wong was also contracted to. And she starred in six films directed by von Sternberg at Paramount between 1930 and 1935. Morocco in 1930, Blonde Venus 1932, Shanghai Express in 1932, which we will mention, come back to, because obviously she was with Anne Mae Wong in Shanghai Express. But by 1938, the American critics were declaring her box office poison, and obviously I think probably at this stage of Dietrich's career, with the rise of Nazism in Germany, she was, suffering from being German. Leni Riefenstahl on the right is the third woman, most known for Triumph of the Will, the documentary on the Nuremberg rallies and her associations, her close associations with Hitler and the Nazi Party. I think she's a fascinating character. I don't know if anyone's seen the documentary, The Wonderful Horrible Life of Leni Riefenstahl, where she talks a lot about her career. I'll begin with the beginning of her career. She was, again, a dancer. She had an actress, and she had her first sort of leading role at the Holy Mountain, Der Heilige Berg, and appeared in the so-called mountain films, the Berg films, which is like this genre of German cinema which focused around people climbing mountains and various heroic exploits like that. And she appeared in The White Hell of Pitzpalu. And in 1932, she appeared in the film The Blue Light, Das Blaue Licht, which is, I think, really, forget how pioneering Leni Riefenstahl was. She acted in it, she directed and edited it. And if you go back and watch it now, whatever her politics or how close her associations were with the Nazi Party, which is, again, open to some closer debate, she was a bloody amazing filmmaker, and for a woman at this time as well. So 1935, Triumph of the Will, she made Olympia, the famous documentary on the Berlin Olympics, and just look at what an amazing piece of cinema, groundbreaking piece of cinema that was. But it's obviously after the war, the fact that she made Triumph of the Will pretty much killed her career. So that was the end of Leni Riefenstahl. So what I'm saying is actually a lot of people are going about Anne Mae Wong's miserable career trajectory, and what I would like to point out is that actually it wasn't that bad for like an actress of that time. I mean, whether they're German or American, you could think of plenty of Hollywood actresses. Louise Brooks is a great example. You know, had to come to Europe to make her best films. And she was basically couldn't get hired after 1935. And one of the theories I always have as well is that in the silent era, it was very easy for films to circulate because all you'd have to do is just take the print, remove the subtitles, replace them with the other language. With the talkies, it was just impossible. You either had to dub or subtitle. Or you could make what was called the multi-language version, which was a case of, if you look at the filmographies of Anne Mae Wong, for this film, there's about three titles that are listed for 1930. So if you were if you weren't too careful, you'd think, oh, she made a film in Germany, she made a film in France, and she made a film in England. And in fact, they were all the same film. This film, The Flame of Love, and It was, again, it was a British international picture by Richard Eichberg. And it was her first talkie. And it was released in Germany with, well, they just basically reshot all the scenes with everyone speaking German. So Anna May Wong was acting in German. And interestingly, all of the cast are the same, the English and German versions. So, you know, obviously all of the cast were fluent in both languages. You get to the French version, which was called, sorry, I don't remember, did I write it down? Ah, L'amour Mitre des Choses. All the casts are different, apart from Anna May Wong. It's like everyone around has been replaced by French actors. It's set in pre-revolutionary Russia, and it's a doomed love affair. It's always a doomed love affair. A doomed love affair between a young Chinese dancing girl, another dancing girl role, and Lieutenant Boris, the assistant to a Russian Grand Duke. And she dies at the end. And actually, it's a really similar story when you watch them. It's really similar to Piccadilly. And I think there's, because it's, you know, basically a silent film with bits of dialogue inserted in. I mean, a lot of it is scenes of the cabaret dancing and her song and dance routines. So it feels a bit like a musical review. And a lot of the early talkies she made in Britain were quite similar. There was one called Chu Chin Chow, which was like a version of the Arabian Nights, made in 1934. It's a truly horrible film. But lots of singing and dancing in that. Anna May Wong playing the slave girl again. And then there was Elstree Tree Calling, which was like a musical review film with multiple directors, including Hitchcock actually directed the section. But it was all like end of the pier variety show stuff, like magicians and comedians. And Anna May Wong turns up in a cameo where she reprises. She comes wearing her Piccadilly outfit and comes in squawking in Chinese and then throws a custard pie in someone's face.
Costume. It's quite revealing. Yes. How the censorship that time, looking about her image, it's like so revealing.
She does seem to wear a lot less than a lot of actresses at the time. I mean, I don't in British cinema. I mean, certainly if you look at German films from the 20s, they seem to have a lot more nudity in it than they seem to be a lot more revealing than.
Is that acceptable?
And yeah. Then Hollywood had the Hays Code, the censorship bill came in 1930s, but there was sort of vague, you know. But I mean, perhaps it's the same as. There's a really funny film, I can't remember the title of it, but it was like a travelogue film of the visit to Angkor Wat. They brought up this 1910 travelogue film, and some producer in America decided to film all these scenes with these. Topless women carrying all the expedition's equipment, but they were clearly weren't tight. They were like recruited from some local bordello, I think, and that managed to get shown in the UK and passed with open to England because it was you know ethnological nudity. It's you know it's this is how people look in those days. So there's all those jokes about National Geographic readers, so. But yeah, I think she does wear pretty revealing clothing in this, and obviously this is part of her appeal as a star. So yeah, the use of sound here was more for the musical song and dance numbers in this film. And this whole idea, the multiple language version, this was a practice that lasted probably about a year when everyone realised that you're using three times as much film, different actors, and it's just expensive and impractical. So that's when, pretty much from that moment, Hollywood colonised the world, and because people were used to reading subtitles or watching dub versions of American films. But I also think, I always have this idea that it's also coincides with this whole rise of fascism, because my own expertise is in Japanese cinema, and as soon as the language started coming in, people retreated back into their own domestic cinema a lot, and I don't think there was that whole flow of international communication that the was before. So I that's just my idea. I don't know if anyone's done any massive studies on it. Um, Yeah, and I mentioned that, you know, in these films she's obviously this object of desire and she always ends up dead in the films. But, I mean, this is largely, you know, attributed to her ethnicity. But then I also think of the idea of Louise Brooks as well in Pandora's Box and things like that. So it wasn't unique to Anna May Wong, even though it was a big feature of her career. And also the British films, it didn't matter where they were set, if it was like Limehouse, Chinatown, the Middle East, or whatever. They always feel like sort of fancy dress party for me. It's just, it seems to be nothing authentic or genuine about the cultures that they're representing. So it was just like, this story could have been set anywhere, but they put it in pre-revolutionary Russia and just have people wearing big fluffy hats. And this is one of the things that, I mean, throughout Anna May Wong's career, and I think this is interesting that Anna May Wong always made a big emphasis on her Chinese culture and her upbringing and language, and this is how Chinese women wear their hair, and this is why I wear these Chinese dresses, and she really emphasised this, but she's really playing this big hodgepodge of things, you know, say, in Piccadilly. Anyway, so she went back to America for a brief while. I should also mention that, yes, so when the talkie came in, she'd actually, in the Piccadilly Review, actually it was the City Butterfly Review, it mentioned at the end, it said her stage appearance in London proved that her voice is unsuitable for the talkies. Because she just appeared in this film, The Chalk Circle, made her West End debut in 1929, playing alongside Laurence Olivier. And the Circle of Chalk was an adaptation of the 13th century classic of Chinese literature, and she played a character called Hai Tang, which carried her name across. And one critic at the time went on about her Yankee squeak. So actually the British were condescending her just not because she was like Chinese, but because she was American, which is sort of interesting. And she actually had elocution lessons in the UK. And when you look at her talkie films, she does sound a lot like Margaret Thatcher. and she made the transition to talkies successfully, whereas Lon Chaney, Man of a Thousand Faces, Mr. Wu, his career ended when sound came in. One of the interesting questions is, would her career have continued if she'd moved back to the US instead of being in London? Anyway, she did go back to the US, and this was a sort of juncture to appear in. And I remember having a conversation with someone and he said, oh, well, I think Anna May Wong is far more interesting as a phenomenon than she is as an actress. I don't think she's a great actress. But I think she's great in the silent films, but I think the problem is that it's the availability of what we have to see of her films. Very little is on DVD. In the UK, we can't really access the American prints of the films. The Americans can't really see the British unless they're specifically organised retrospectives. And a lot of the stuff she appeared in the 30s in America were B-movies, programme pictures, you know, just intended to fill up the lower half of a double bill. So this is Daughter of the Dragon, and it's the version. It belongs to the Fu Manchu series, the Sax Roma's character, the Chinese master fiend. So the first Doctor Fu Manchu. Actually, it's interesting. The Variety reviews of Piccadilly. It's on the other page. Dr. Fu Manchu, where they described it as a first-class murder mystery story. It starred an actor, Warner Oland, who's a Swedish-American actor who specialised in playing Fu Manchu or Charlie Chan. And he said that the reason he was always cast in these Oriental roles was because he had some vague Mongolian ancestry, but I don't think that was true at all. Just a story. But this was the third... So actually, yeah, and the first Dr. Fu Manchu was all talky as well. It was not a silent film. So it came out at the same time as Piccadilly with dialogue. This is the third one, and it didn't have Fu Manchu in the title because Paramount didn't have the rights to the third novel. But I'll give you it's at the beginning... intertitle of the film. It says, demented by the accidental death of his wife and son during the Boxer Rebellion in China, He wrongly placed the blame on General Petrie and swore to wipe out the entire Petrie family. Today, the daughter of Fu Manchu, unaware of her father's identity, stands on the verge of a startling experience. So she gets her revenge, and she plays the villainess and Borna Oland as her father. And again, this has the actor Sesue Hayakawa, the Japanese-American actor, plays a fairly thankless supporting role, but he's a Chinese detective who's brought in, working for Scotland Yard to bring down the Fu Manchu evil empire. And also, I think the British characters in this are fairly caricatured as well when you watch it. But again, when sound film came in, I think from like 1930, 1931, films are generally pretty awful, because you had this great evolution of silent film language and beautiful moving camera works, use of light and shadow. Sounds came in and the equipment was so loud they had to box off the camera so it never moved. A lot of them early talkies just looked like film theatre. And really, she appeared in lots of stuff like this. Really, the career-defining moments for Anna May Wong came with this film, The Good Earth, where she was up. It was like going to be a massive production of the 1931 novel by Pearl Buck about struggling Chinese farmers. And she went for the casting role, and it went to Louise Rayner, blonde-haired, blue-eyed actress who was painted yellow hair, dyed black, and there she was there. But because of this rule, you couldn't have interracial kissing on screen. And so the annoying thing is this film won 5 Academy Awards. Louise Rayner won for the Best Actress. Best Cinematography, Karl Freund, German emigre. So this could have been the massive breakthrough film, and I guess at this stage, Anna May Wong was like, threw up her hands in despair, and what can you do? I mean, it's like, if I can't play an authentic Chinese character, then what can I do? But at this point, I mean, she said throughout her entire career, she straddled 2 cultures. She wasn't sure if she was Chinese or American. But at this point, she'd never been, well, she first went to China in 1936 to visit her ancestral home, Toishan in Guangdong province. And I found that dug out an article called East Meets West by Louise Lung in a magazine from the time. And it says, in Nanking, she was guest of honour at a huge reception, attended by leading government officials. And quote, Anna May Wong says, they made speeches that lasted for 4 hours, but instead of the usual stereotyped welcome to our city speeches, they all took turns berating me for the roles I had played. Since I didn't speak Mandarin then, I had to answer in English. I told them that when a person is trying to get established in a profession, he can't choose parts, he has to take what is offered. I said I'd come to China to learn and that I hope I'd be able to interpret our country in a better light. It all ended up with their apologising to me. And she said, of course she laughed. When Warner Oland went to China, he was simply lauded up to the skies. No one ever thought of bringing up his evil past as a Chinese villain in such pictures as Daughter of the Dragon. Seriously, though, I can understand why government officials are so earnest about this censorship idea. Not because they are hypersensitive, but because they are self-conscious and want to see their best sides, not their worst. So basically, Anna May Wong wasn't popular in China. And again, same with Sesue Hayakawa, Japanese-American actor. He appeared in a couple of films in Japan, but he was never seen as a star. He wasn't popular at all. So I want to just finally wind up by saying, you know, the couple of her standout, and I mentioned her legacy as an actress, and I think she appeared in a lot of dross, and she would admit it too. And what's available on DVD at the moment doesn't really do her justice, I think. But here are some of the gems from her back catalogue, and I mentioned von Sternberg's Shanghai Express, which is set in the Civil War in China in 1931. With Marlene Dietrich as Shanghai Lily and her companion Hui Fei, Anna May Wong, passengers on the express train from Beijing to Shanghai. This was the highest grossing movie in America in 1932. Anna May Wong was paid a fraction of what Marlene Dietrich was paid for the role. But I think when you watch the film, she stands up. She basically at least equal to Marlene Dietrich's appearance. And I'm going down, actually. Daughters of Shanghai is a real surprise. It's not a well-known film at all. It's a B-movie. But it was directed by Robert Flory, who's a really interesting character, because I didn't really know until I did a bit of research that I actually had more Robert Flory films in my DVD collection than any other director. And he was a French director. He made an experimental film in called The Death of a Hollywood Extra in 1928, but he really did lots of potboilers. He did a lot of the Tarzan films, and he made Beast with Five Fingers, a horror film. He was going to direct Frankenstein at the beginning, but James Whale took over, so that's how his career could have gone. But he was sort of... This film's really interesting because it's set in the world of human trafficking, and it focuses, like, illegal American gangs bringing over Chinese labour, and Anna May Wong and her sidekick, Philip Ahn, go and infiltrate this ring and bring them to justice. Philip Ahn was an interesting Korean-American director who I don't know much about, but I did discover he was at school with Anna May Wong, and they also appeared in lots of films together. They actually have ends with a romantic bit where they're just heading off in a taxi to New York and about to get married, so I think this is like a happy ending for Anna May Wong, even though they don't have a screen kiss. But Java Head, this is like a bit of a surprise. I mean, the racial politics are a bit odd in this. It's set in the world of sibling rivalry, drug addiction, and racial miscegenation in 19th century Bristol. And it involves this shipping, a family, the shipping industry in Bristol, and one of the sons goes off on a world voyage and comes back with this big surprise, his Chinese wife. Again, he ends up, she gets more and more Chinese and starts burning incense in the bedroom and praying at a big Buddha, and he goes, well, what have I done? And ends up going off with the blonde next door neighbour, and she kills herself. But I'm going to show a clip. It is actually really well made, and the director, I don't know if anyone knows his name, Thorold Dickinson, made the British version of Gaslight. He was like an incredibly good British director from the period, who's much undervalued. Now I can find it. There we have it. Anna May Wong's first screen kiss. And, as far as I know, that must be the first interracial screen kiss anywhere in the world. Because if you look up on the internet, they will always go, it happened in the 50s. No one ever mentions this film. So, there you go, in a British film, no less. Anyway, well, that's that clip. Yeah, and then just towards the end of her career, so she appeared after the career setback that was The Good Earth. She made a couple of films, Lady Chungking and Bombs Over Burma, which were pro-Chinese, anti-Japanese war films. Quite low-budget B-movies, only about an hour long. Then retired from the screen for a long time, but her later roles... Impact is a rather good film noir thriller. They're both in film noirs, but Anna May Wong, she gets quite high billing. She's only in it for about 5 minutes, and she plays a housemaid. And in Portrait in Black, she was also a housemaid, another film noir thriller. What is really interesting is that... this was her last role in a film. She died very shortly afterwards, age only 55. But this and Told of the Sea were her only colour films. So at the beginning of her career she appeared in a colour film, and the end of her career in a colour film, and then everything else in between was black and white. So She was on TV. She was in a TV series, 1951. I can't quite remember the title of the, because I haven't, obviously can't see 1950s TV shows, not very easy to access. But yes, The Gallery of Madame Su Long, where she played a detective. And so she was in the first Asian American lead in a US television show. So she died in 1961 at the age of 56, so really young. In Graham Hodges' books, I think he insinuates it was a heart attack, but he insinuates that it was her party girl sort of drinking and smoking lifestyle, and there's a hint of this tragic narrative here that she was so disappointed by her love life that didn't, she was never married, never had children, and never got the roles she wanted, and so it makes her life look like one of constant misery. And I don't like to think of her like that, because I think, you know, she had a long career. She was a Hollywood star, not just a Chinese-American star. She was a Hollywood star. She had the first starring role in a colour feature. She was only 16. She was a massive star in Europe, and she had her own TV show. And she, I think when you watch her in a good film she's in, she was really good. And final thing, yes. This is the other thing. She appeared in Technicolor, did a one-reel show to advertise the new superior Technicolor process. This was just a couple of years before The Wizard of Oz and around that time, Becky Sharp. So it was Chinese costume party, and Anna May Wong appears in about halfway through in a whole load of very awesome, exotic, colourful dresses. But yeah, you can see that on YouTube as well. So yeah, and that's it. That's the life of Anna May Wong.